This is the State of Things live from Upstage Cabaret at the Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you. Thank you. 4 years ago this fall, Cheryl Rowland was preparing for his first semester of graduate school at UNC Greensboro when he got a phone call that changed the direction of his life. It was a detective calling from Washington, D.C., saying that there had been a warrant out for his arrest. He told the detective he didn't understand and it must be a mistake. But things moved quickly, and within a year, he was charged with crimes he did not commit. Served 10.5 months in a D.C. jail that had a reputation for deplorable conditions and inmate mistreatment. Last year, Cheryl was exonerated of all charges, but he has not let go of the experience and, in fact, still wears an orange jumpsuit. But this time, it's by choice. It's part of a public art endeavor called the Jumpsuit Project, through which he hopes to raise awareness about incarceration. Cheryl Rowland is now in his final year of a Master of Fine Arts program at UNC Greensboro, and he joins me now on the State of Things. Welcome, Cheryl. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Take us back a bit. Tell us about your life before all this happened. You grew up in Asheville, right?
Yes, sir.
And you were thinking about going to college. How long had that been an aspiration for you?
Well, I really didn't know anything about college per se. I just, you know, I had uncles and aunts who just was like, what are you doing after high school? And I was like, I don't know. They was like, no, you're going to college. And so that's kind of how it happened.
And how did you get interested in art?
Well, I was always drawing when I was little. I had friends who, you know, kind of encouraged it once they saw me sketching comic books and magazines and things of that nature. And then my art teachers kind of encouraged it as well. One way they made art fun was that they played music in art classes. No other class did that. So I thought, why not? Yeah. Keep going.
You know? And you were working with superheroes and action figures and that kind of thing initially. So you get here. What then led you to UNCG?
It was close, but it was also far away from Asheville. As a young man, I wanted to kind of get out underneath my mom's wings. I didn't go as far as I wanted to, but Greensboro was a good stop.
It was a good stop, except that you were out from under your mother's wings, the aunts, all of those people encouraging you, a young man in Greensboro, North Carolina. That first year didn't go that well for you.
No, it didn't. Responsibility was a word I had to learn, for sure. And it took me some time to kind of get that. But I was sent home and then had a different mother then. She wasn't the same mother I had left. You know, she had different different words of encouragement.
And did she suddenly seem a little smarter to you than you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Amazing how college does that to your parents. So you're feeling it now. You're feeling a little bit of pressure. You're feeling a very different relationship with them. Was it a big transition for you? I mean, was it a moment, an awakening for you suddenly?
Yes. I mean, you know, just a growing up stage, you know, my mom was able to, you know, instill certain things that allowed me to take more responsibility over my actions and that, you know, my success depended on my decisions and the effort that I put into it.
And you did put in some effort, went back, you went to community college, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had to go to community college, had to pay my own bills, so to speak, you know. And then that, you know, doing that, I hated it, but hated it enough that drove me to get back into school.
That's right. Yet another escape to Greensboro, and you did come back here for grad school. Or did you do undergrad?
It went back to undergrad.
Yeah.
And then I got back with the same friends that I was with before, and we were all kind of on a different page, a more assertive, more driven page, ambitious page. And, you know, we all just kind of encouraged each other. They became, you know, people that I could, you know, take these steps and success with. And we all kind of saw our goals being met before we, you know, graduated.
That's interesting. So some of those same friends who you were partying with and ended up getting thrown out because of also had a similar kind of transformation.
And
you could hang together, support each other. You did get into grad school. You're pursuing art. You're in your first year of grad school, and then you get the phone call.
Then I get the phone call. Very first, well, the Thursday before the very first day. So I got that call. Like anybody who would receive that call, I assume, you know, just out of the blue, I was very excited to start school, so this was definitely not the direction, the complete opposite direction I was kind of wanting to go into.
All right, that gets you to grad school. Now you're in grad school. Then you get another phone call, and that phone call is a 202 area code.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Washington, D.C., so tell us about that call.
Yeah, naturally, I didn't know if I should answer it. I didn't have that number saved in my contacts. But something, something, the notion came upon, like, you should answer this. And once I did, I kind of didn't believe what was going on. And I asked, how serious was this?
Well, tell us what it was. Tell us what you heard on the other end of that phone.
Okay, yeah. He was just saying that, he stated his name and that he was a detective. And that he needed to talk to me as soon as possible. I told him, I asked him what for. He was like, you have a warrant out for your arrest. I asked, what is this warrant? And he said he wasn't allowed to tell me over the phone. And then I asked the severity of it, and he said he wasn't allowed to say that either. And I was like, well, is it something that would kind of blow over? I think you guys made a mistake. One, I can't get up there. I start graduate school, this, that, and the fourth. And he was like, no, if you are pulled over or anything down in North Carolina, you will be immediately transported to D.C. As opposed to, like, arrested until you, like, stand in front of a judge and to assess this warrant.
So what did you do at that time? And were you taking it seriously, or did you?
I was kind of in shock.
Yeah.
And like anything, it's just kind of like, well, let me talk this over with my mother and see what I can do. So I waited to get in contact with my mother, told her about this, and naturally she's asking me the same questions, like, what is this about? What is this? And I'm just like, I don't know, but oddly enough, that's a conversation that happened for the next 3 years in a sense of like, I don't know. But essentially, we worked it out, and I was able to go up there and stay with my cousin to kind of turn myself in for this warrant and to see what it was all about. And even at that time, all the details were not explained to me.
Had you even been, this is up in D.C., so I'm assuming that whatever it was that happened, that they say happened, would have happened in D.C. Had you even been to D.C.?
Yes, but at this moment of the call, I hadn't been to D.C. in over like 2-3 years. Yeah. So I was like, I have no idea what you guys could be talking about.
So you ended up in an interrogation room. What did they tell you then?
Very vaguely, things of suggestion of what, people I may have known, places I may have been, asking where, where I was at and things of that nature. And at this moment, in TV shows and stuff like that, I always assume people are like, don't talk to anybody unless you got a lawyer type of situation. But that's kind of like hindsight in a sense. For me, it was like, I didn't do anything. I'm going to go see what this is about. And even at the very notion of that, I had a warrant out for my arrest and going up there to see about it, I didn't even know I would be interrogated or stripped of my belongings, arrested, and things of that nature, sit into a cell, all before 5 o'clock in the morning before I was then transported to be seated in front of a judge.
Wow.
So, like, the whole process of that in the beginning was completely unaware. I thought it was just going to be, like, a conversation with a detective.
Well, so tell us about that. I mean, what does happen to you first? And give us the sequence maybe in a little more detail. I mean, who did you see first, and when did all of these other things happen when you start losing your belongings and taken to jail?
Yeah, so this particular detective was located at one of the precincts around D.C., so I had to go to that one, which was many miles away from the city center, Pennsylvania Avenue or whatever. And once I got there, I had to turn over all my belongings, shoestrings. So basically, you go through the same process as being arrested. And then I waited in a cell with no mattress or anything. I just remember it being very cold, shiny aluminum. Even though it was shiny, there were still, like, mouses that ran across the cell door. Come on. Like, it's like,
right.
Where am I at right now? And then I had to wait until the detective came around, and then he took me into an interrogation room.
Were you charged with a crime at that point?
No, I was not.
Did they tell you what the charges were going to be?
Yeah, they told me. I still can't talk about them, but I can tell you that it was 4 felony charges. But to the specifically, I wasn't made aware of that until the judge told me that.
Yeah. And you can't talk about that because, in fact, your record has been expunged. This was such a heinous miscarriage of justice that not only were you exonerated but expunged. There is no record of this because it was you're exonerated. We'll get to that part of the story. But what are you thinking at this point? You're thinking, oh, I'm going to go up and straighten all this out, and then it'll all be over. And no, you're in a holding cell. You got no belongings, and now you're about to see a judge. And by the way, you don't have a lawyer. What are you thinking?
Don't have a lawyer. Yeah, I'm just trying to process what's all happening. The main concern for me is just to be released. The detective told me that if I'm not processed quick enough, I have to be transported from this precinct in D.C. to Pennsylvania Avenue. to be seen with a lot of other people who have been collected across the city. So it's a very packed room, waiting room of other people who have to be seen by the a judge. So through this process, my last name is Roland, so if I miss that count, if it's in alphabetical order, then I would have to go back to jail, spend the night in jail, and then be wait to see him first thing again the next morning.
I'll tell you what, we'll continue this story with Cheryl Roland, a graduate student at UNC Greensboro, pursuing his Master's of Fine Arts, creator of the Jumpsuit Project, a public art project to raise awareness about incarceration. That conversation will continue, but first, some music from AM Rodeo. They are Jessica Mashburn on keyboard and vocals, Evan Olson on the guitar and vocals. They'll be performing every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at Printworks Bistro at the Proximity Hotel in Greensboro. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our conversation continues in a moment, but first, the music of AM Rodeo. This is The State of Things, broadcasting live from the Upstage Cabaret, a triad stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Cheryl Roland, a graduate student at UNC Greensboro, and the creator of the Jumpsuit Project, a public art project based on his experience serving 10 and a half months in prison for a crime he didn't commit. So you're in the holding center, you see the judge, and then you're formally charged, right?
Yes. Not exactly. I'm waiting for trial now. Right. Well, necessarily what happens if you do get the trial is an indictment. So the time for an indictment to be reached is 9 months. Right. So I have to wait until 9 months or in between that if they reach an indictment.
All right, so then you go back home or go back to Greensboro, right?
Yes, I'm allowed to return to school. The court-appointed lawyer that they gave me allowed for me to ask for that. Because once again, I can't speak on my behalf. I had to have somebody to speak
with. So you got a court-appointed lawyer. They're up in D.C. You're back here. You've got this now four felonies hanging over your head 9 months from now at a trial in D.C. What's that like for you going to school with your family? What was it like for you?
My family was very positive. They wanted to keep, make sure you maintain focus on your school. The same notion that everybody, I'm sure, will receive is in this situation is if you didn't do anything, you have nothing to worry about. So that's kind of the mindset that I had. I didn't do anything. This should just blow over. It should work itself out. Something's going on up there that can, that should work itself out. So no matter what, I still have to kind of proceed with the things that I had planned.
Right, that's what they're telling you. How are you feeling about this?
Shocked, beside myself. Mm-hmm. Just totally confused. It's hard to put words on that in the sense of where does this come from? How does this happen? Things of that nature. I'm sure anybody, I just try to explain it in a way of like in the smallest terms, like if you, as kids, someone says you did something that you didn't do and you're kind of like, I didn't do it. So that's kind of how I felt like.
And nobody's believing you, at least in the criminal justice system. So exactly. Now you're back up. Let's take us forward 9 months and the day of the trial. Tell us about that day.
Back it up 9 months in the day of the trial.
Yeah, we go forward nine months.
Okay,
now,
trial. The indictment was never reached. So the Thursday before that 9 month deadline, they dropped it down. I got a call from my lawyer that said they couldn't reach an indictment, so they had two choices in the sense of dropping those charges or lowering the charges to misdemeanors, which then goes straight to a trial, to a bench trial, where it's just a judge deciding my fate.
So they couldn't get an indictment.
Couldn't reach an indictment.
They didn't have enough evidence to get an indictment, but they say, well, okay, so we don't have anything here, but we can still charge you with something. And in fact, we can make things go faster because we'll drop it to misdemeanors.
Drop it to misdemeanors. Yep. So that's what they did. And then that, then I had to wait from May to October when a trial date was set. In between there, there was stationary hearings and things to make sure that the dates met on both sides and things of that nature. But October 7th, 2013 was the date that was set for my trial.
All right, tell us about that then.
Well, I mean, as you can imagine, I went a lot of places that summer. I'm in grad school, so they took me over to Italy for Biennale in Venice and things of that nature. So everything always, like, even through the first 9 months and after they dropped the trials to a lower charge, it was always a gray cloud over everything. So every happy moment, there was always a sense of like, but there's a chance I could lose it all. So it's a hard thing to kind of work hard for something that you could potentially lose with what I had hanging over my head.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine. I mean, it's one thing to say, I didn't do anything, so I know I didn't do it. But there are these charges. There are these guys up there who said, yes, you did, yeah. And it's a felony. And so if that could possibly happen, if I could possibly be charged for a thing that I didn't do, yeah. I'm in a system now that could actually convict me.
Yeah.
So that you can't. Yeah, that can't go away. I can imagine.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, that you know, saying what is, you know, prepare for the worst, expect the best, prepare for the worst, yeah. Kind of thing. So it was like, how can I really, I have no idea what the worst could be in the situation I've never been in. So it's hard for me to plan, let alone keep it a secret from everybody else who loves me and supports me.
Did you feel you needed to do that, though? I mean, obviously your family knew, but did you have to keep it from a secret from colleagues and fellow students?
It was instructed by my attorney to not even tell many people. I mean, a lot of people, even in my family, my close family, did not know. And it, you know, it was a tough thing to kind of explain to them after the fact, after I was sent away. Because even at that point, you know, communication is not as easy as it was before the trial.
So tell us about the trial.
It was very quick. In a sense, it only took 2 days. And that quickness is something that I kind of reflect back on. I did a lot of forgiving through this whole situation. Like, how could someone make this assessment about me without having time to get to know me? And I've only spent like probably less time than I'm on this radio in over those 2 days on a stand for them to actually get to know me. And so just thinking about all of that is like, how could you place a judgment or decide my fate in a sense without even knowing my character or the person who I am? And I think that's what it kind of was. It wasn't a sense of an evidence or witnesses or anything like that. It was just my word against the opposing side word. And so that's kind of what I was kind of dealing with in a sense. Like, you know, lies can be very extravagant, but the truth is very simple. And so, like, how much can I exhaust the truth when it's only so much I can say that, like, I wasn't the person or did this and, you know, that. And so that's mostly kind of like what the trial was.
Right, and you have a few hours on the stand. As you say, they don't know you. They know those police officers. They know those prosecutors. It's one big happy family, unfortunately, the way it works. And we've seen it played out over and over. Police and prosecutors work together. So when they're trying to oversee each other, it raises serious questions because they do know each other very well in those judges.
Yeah.
You were convicted.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm not, you know, Cheryl Rowland in a sense of someone who has a future or who has a story or who's another person that you can help. It's just, it felt like I was just number, you know, 44 on a 45 docket.
Tell us about the sentencing then. You were sentenced to
a year and 30 days. And even at that moment, I didn't really know what that meant, but all the charges were, you know, consecutive. So it was a full time, a year and 30 days, Four misdemeanors, yes, sir.
Okay, so then you go to the D.C. jail. Tell us about that.
Where do I begin? I mean, it's tough to kind of explain, too. I'll just say, like, every place is different. Every place has its different culture. And those people who inhabit that system. And that goes across the board as far as people who run the jail and also people who are incarcerated within them. D.C. jail is now the hub, I believe, in D.C. Their state prison was closed down a few years before I got sentenced. Their state prison used to be in Lorton, Virginia. And so now everything kind of gets thrown into the center city jail, which is very crowded and overpacked at sometimes. But just to paint a picture, the year that I went in was like marked the most suicides in this jail, like historic numbers for them. And they made the Washington Post, you know, because you can't really, you can hide the fights and the injuries, but you can't necessarily hide the deaths. And so that was a big issue about this jail before I even went
there. They did a series on the deplorable conditions there. And remember, Lorton, you talked about that, was built because there was such an overflow. They simply closed Lorton because the conditions there were even more deplorable, but they didn't expand the jail. So now you're crowding all these people into that place.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, a series on how awful the conditions are. So what was the condition? How did you experience it?
I mean, I had no choice. I mean, not even going to the first block that I was assigned to, I kind of got the gist of what it was like just going through the process of me being, you know, issued a number, things that are, you know, being put in their system. I mean, in one jail cell, like at least 20 of us was there just waiting to get kind of processed, but it was at least five in a row that was packed with that many people who had just came in for that one day or that evening. And so, you know, just how that whole process was of being stripped naked in front of everybody, and then just being tossed your belongings, the jumpsuit, the two white t-shirts, two boxers, two socks, things of that nature, and then being asked about my tattoos and if I was gang related and anything like that, and then whether I wanted to be in isolation or in general population or anything like that, and just kind of like going through the mugshots and all that, you know, to be put on a wristband. It was all very cold, and it just didn't feel real.
What was it like when you first put on that orange jumpsuit?
It was heavy. You know, I didn't have anything underneath it at first, you know, in the sense of like a shirt. And I just remember like taking that mugshot that was on my wristband that kind of looked like a hospital wristband, except it was like a metal clip, so you couldn't take it off. But just remember it just being very cold in that, like, you know, everything is shut off. Like, you don't really see any light anymore. You're in the bottom of the jail, literally, when you get processed. And just putting on that jumpsuit, it was missing buttons. It was completely oversized. The guy who threw me the jumpsuit, you know, he was like, "What size are you?" He looked at me, and I had no idea what he was talking about because I'm unaware of this process. Man. And he was like, "You look like a 4X." And he just grabbed one and then just tossed it down from me.
Talk about your cell, because you were confined to a cell for 23 hours a day, right?
Yeah, the first block that I was assigned to was 23-hour lockdown.
And so you get 1 hour out. But describe that condition, because really you're sharing the cell. You're wide open. There's like one toilet in the middle, and there you are, the two of you. And and you get out for 1 hour. But if there's a lockdown during your 1 hour out, then you miss it for 24 hours, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah. So they alternate the hour that you're out. There's two sides to every block. So if I'm on the left side, my hour may be the lunch hour for today. And then the right side will have the dinner hour. So if there's a lockdown, like in any other block, if there's a confrontation or altercation of other inmates or where they have to lock down the jail, then my hour on lunch, if it happened during that time, will get lost, and then I won't pick it up until the next day for my dinner. So it just alternates. Yeah. So sometimes lockdowns could take up to a week, depending on the amount of.
So you were supposed to serve a year and 30 days. It got shortened. Tell us that what happened there.
Well, I looked up and got a job, and it's not as easy as finding a job out here in the real world in the sense of putting in an application. But I got a job which took days off, and good behavior also took days off. But I was not aware of how much time was taking off until 6 months until that due date. They won't calculate that information for you until you're closer to a release date.
And tell us how ultimately the court came to find that this had been a horrible miscarriage of justice.
Well, some new information that came upon, but that happened over the last summer that I was there, like practically June, July, and my release date was in August. The very last week before I got released, I was seen by a new set of lawyers. And I cried a little bit while we were meeting because they told me that they believed that I was innocent and that they could help me out. And it was the first time, I mean, you know, I know I am. I know I, you know, am innocent. My family knows. I believe that they do know. But to hear that from someone who has the power, I understood then about the power structure. Like, you know, no matter, even in the trial, I had no voice. Someone had to speak on my behalf. And to have someone who has power come in and tell me that they would come and speak for me about my innocence was just kind of like, I mean, for what all I had just, you know, served, just kind of blew my mind in the sense that there could be a way, because I had a court-appointed appeal lawyer that I also was in communication with, sent me papers and over the phone, and he told me I had no chance. Oh. He told me that, you know, there was just no opportunity.
Ultimately, the same judge who heard your initial trial then overturned the verdict, and ultimately your record was expunged, right?
Yes, yes. In April 2015, I had a retrial, and the other side didn't even show up, so it was immediate, like, dismissal.
But then it's another step. I mean, it's one thing to get the charges dismissed, but then this was so bad they actually expunged the record.
Yeah, yeah, and then step. December 2015, I had to go to trial again to be seen by that same lawyer again for a bill of innocence.
All right, so tell us about the project now, this art project, wearing an orange jumpsuit on campus.
Well, yeah, it started with a simple question of, you know, what would happen if I wore it? It all came up in a sense of how, you know, once I got my name back, I spoke with my lawyers and my family, and we celebrated, and the conversation, you know, statements were made, like, you can pick up where you left off, you return to the person you used to be, but in trying to do that and attempting to get my life back, I just couldn't figure it out. I couldn't explain the 3-year gap. I couldn't talk around it. You know, in interviews they're like, so what have you been up to? And I'm like, traveling. but yeah, it was very difficult, and I seemed like I spent so much time hiding this, avoiding it, almost lying about it, that I didn't, like, now that it seems that I got my name back, why does it make sense for me to continue to lie about it? A therapeutic way was for me to learn how to accept this experience, to kind of own this, no matter, you know, because I can't change the person who I am now, and I think I have grown. I've changed from the person I was before this happened to me, and I kind of want to accept that and be more open about that.
You decided to go back to school, and in fact had a conversation with an art professor on campus.
Yes,
Cheryl Oering, who was on our show last month.
Yeah.
So tell us about that conversation and the project then you designed.
I had a bigger idea before this one, and she kind of was like, no, you might want to wait off on that one. And then she was like, what's the second one? I was like, well, I don't really know if I should tell you. You know, I was kind of shy because I thought it was very silly. And then I told her, and she was like, yes, you should do that. You should do that. And I thought about it a little more, talked to my family about it. And they, you know, they, as well as Cheryl, was concerned about my safety if I was emotionally stable to kind of take on this type of project. And I didn't know if I was, you know, to be honest, but I couldn't see any other way. I felt like I had to kind of get uncomfortable. I had to start pushing.
How uncomfortable? Tell us what happens when you walk across campus wearing that.
Well, a number of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, sometimes I'm ignored, and people have gotten wind of the project, so I get a lot of support. I get a lot of people, a lot of high fives, a lot of hugs, which is great. And I do have people who run from me, and people who stare and don't know what to expect. They check the back of my shoulders to see if it's a DOC across it. And so I'm in constant communication with the campus police just to be aware of any campus alerts or if I, you know, set someone the wrong way.
But that's interesting in the sense that you are aware of the fact that you need to alert people along the way, at least authorities, because you're actually in danger with this thing.
Yes, and I definitely don't want to be in another situation where I'm, again, questioned about my truth or my innocence.
Right. And then there's also the question, I mean, obviously you're bringing awareness to the American penal system and its inherent injustice, but there's a way in which you could also be reinforcing the stereotype. This is something you've grappled with, right?
Yes, yes. I don't want to, you know, it is about the suit as well, but it's also I'm an African-American male in an orange jumpsuit, too, and I'm very conscious of that, too. I do want to kind of see if this one element of race inside this orange jumpsuit can maybe change people's perspectives, but I think it's a number of different things that we can also talk about that.
What's your hope? What's your hope for this project?
That it won't be my voice. I'm not rare, in a sense. I'm lucky for sure, but there are many more stories out there. There are many more lives that incarceration has affected, And me doing this, I hope to kind of establish a platform or a community where other people can also share their stories, because I think there's a lot more people can learn. My window or the perspective that I'm able to give people is what it was like in the DC jail system and this, that, and the fourth, but there's a lot more people who went in other places, and I think we need those type of windows to kind of be made aware of this and how difficult it may be to, once you get into this, this type of situation. Because I think I challenged, like, this person I was before, I was very naive of how things worked and how bit by bit it has to be. I mean, it took one trial for me to get into trouble, but it took at least three for me to get out of it, and I still have more to go. And yeah. So it's like, I was completely unaware that all this stuff would happen, and I think I'm not the only one. And I think more people who kind of share their stories and their experiences can kind of enlighten other people, so nobody really has to go through this to get this information.
Cheryl Rowland, thank you so much for being on our program. Cheryl Rowland is currently in his second year of a master's in fine arts at UNCG. He is the creator of the Jumpsuit Project. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we'll hear from a Guilford College professor and her response to the refugee crisis. But first, more music from the acoustic pop duo AM Rodeo. We'll be right back.
Have been running, but going nowhere fast. I saw it coming with justice winning last. Sooner or later, you will.